Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A candlelight vigil will be held tonight in the small rural town of Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. Residents there stunned by the news that four teenagers stand accused of randomly selecting a home and agreeing to kill the occupants with a machete and knife. 42-year-old Kimberly Cates was found dead on Sunday. Her 11-year-old daughter remains critically injured. There have been a spate of brutal home invasions recently. A California rapper is accused of randomly killing four people in Virginia last month. Jonathan Van Fleet is city editor for the Nashua Telegraph. And John, is it safe to say that this news in New Hampshire has shaken people there to the core?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think the people of the area could be more shaken from this crime, not only the nature of the crime, but the teens who were arrested.
Well, they're being described as middle-class kids who lived in nice houses in neighboring nice, quiet New England towns, but at least some of them have been in trouble. Do we know any more about what their motive was?
Other than what the authorities have told us, this seems to be a burglary and an intent to kill whomever was inside. They seem to have picked this house at random. There's no indication that they knew the victims.
Well, your newspaper has been talking with criminologists, you know, trying to explain the killings. What are they saying?
We have spoken to a few people who investigated the Zantop murders up near Dartmouth College a few years ago. There's some parallels between the two crimes.
This is the apparently also random murders of two Dartmouth College professors in 2001. Two teenagers who lived near those professors are in prison. And what are the criminologists finding?
Typically, there's a group dynamic. There's a leader among the teenagers. Other participants will go along with the leader. And if the group is separated, none of the individuals would do this type of thing on their own.
Well, let's take a look at the alleged ringleaders in this case up there in Mount Vernon. There's 17-year-old Stephen Spader, a high school dropout. People say he saw himself as some kind of a gang leader. Also, 19-year-old homeschooled Christopher Gribble. On his Facebook page, Christopher describes himself as a Mormon gun and knife enthusiast with mood swings. These two have been charged with murder as opposed to the other two, 18-year-old William Marks and 17-year-old Quinn Glover, who are charged with burglary, armed robbery, and conspiracy to commit burglary, but not murder. Do we know why there's a distinction?
What we've heard is Marks and Glover remained in the basement while Gribble and Spader were actually committing the murders upstairs.
Again, they are just accused of this. Well, William Mark's father describes texting his son all Saturday night at least 15 times when William didn't come home, being up when his son finally walked in Sunday morning around 4:30 a.m., which would have been right after the killings. So in at least one case, there was a parent who was somewhat concerned about where the child was. Have we heard from other families? Is there any explanation for why this might have happened?
We have spoken to some family friends who say the kids kind of were hanging around with the wrong crowd and that they were trying to get them back on the right track.
In the pictures that we see in area newspapers, there's four white teenagers with what looks like shaved heads. Were they skinheads?
Some people have characterized them as that. We were told that they all shaved their heads on Friday, a couple days before the attack.
Do we know, is there anyone making any connection that they might have been preparing for an attack, or do we have any idea?
You had mentioned William Marks' father, James Marks. He was quoted in other news outlets as saying he saw Spader with a knife at his home on Friday night. And a couple bells went off, but he never thought something like this could happen.
Right. You know, people in the area have been just really shaken. This is an area that doesn't lock doors. What's your sense of how it's changed?
Typically, these are people where you know your neighbors and that you don't expect crime to come around in your neighborhoods. There have been some burglaries lately, so people had kind of been out watching out a little bit, but as far as crime in the town of Mount Vernon, the last violent crime, there had only been one other violent crime in the last 10 years in this town.
John, thank you. Jonathan Van Fleet, city editor for the Nashua Telegraph in New Hampshire. Anyone working in a war zone knows there are risks. For CNN camerawoman Margaret Moth, who's covered conflicts in Georgia, the Middle East, Bosnia, the hypothetical became a reality on July 23, 1992, in Sarajevo.
A CNN team covering the war in Sarajevo has come under attack. CNN camerawoman Margaret Moth and CNN correspondent Mark Delmage were wounded this morning by sniper fire. They were in a car patrolling the streets when they came under fire. CNN's Stefan Katsonis was with Moth and Delmage during the shooting, and he joins us now from Sarajevo by phone.
First of all, I'd like to say that Margaret is still in surgery right now, and the doctors have now said that it's not guaranteed that she will survive this. Her injuries to her head and throat are very serious. Even if she does survive it, her life will be very different from now on.
Steph Katsonis reporting on his then 40-something colleague Margaret Moth, who did survive, and despite losing much of her lower face and her ability to speak, Margaret Moth headed right back to Sarajevo after several surgeries and then went on to other war zones. A new CNN documentary on Margaret's life opens with her footage from the West Bank. It's a chaotic scene, Israeli troops ordering reporters out of a tense area. We hear police horns, then an explosion. We hear voices. It's Margaret, her voice distorted by her previous injury, pushed back in her car by her reporter. She's almost laughing, and she's still filming. Through her lens, we see someone fire point blank right at her into a bulletproof windshield. Margaret Moth dodged that bullet, but she couldn't avoid the next one, which came in the form of an aggressive cancer. We've reached her at a hospice in Minnesota to talk more about the new CNN documentary about her life. It's called Fearless, The Margaret Moth Story. Margaret, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. And we want to remind people your speech was obviously affected by that sniper attack in Sarajevo. So here to help us tell your story in the studio with us is the reporter who was in that car with you then, Steph Katsonis, who's also our colleague here at WBUR in Boston. Steph, thanks so much for coming in, too.
Thanks, Robin. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, Stephen. How are you?
Fine. How are you feeling?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
First of all, the title of the documentary, they say Fearless. Were you really? Were you ever afraid?
I don't know whether I would think of it like that. I don't think I'm fearless. That would be a unhealthy way to be.
You don't think you're fearless? That would not be good.
I can tell you stories of times when my legs have literally shaken.
You have the stories of the legs shaking, and I'm sure much worse in war zones. And Steph, that would be, as you have also been a longtime war correspondent, that would be the smart approach to covering a war.
To be afraid.
Yes.
Yes, be afraid. Be very afraid, but be calm.
Well, Steph, we know that Margaret, and maybe thankfully, doesn't remember anything of the day that she was shot by snipers in Sarajevo, but you, sitting next to her in the car, remember everything. Can you just give us a sense of, you know, what happened, what that day was like?
Well, I mean, it's just awful. The thing was to get her to the hospital. I knew it was bad, and then it started, your eyes kind of slowly start understanding what's going on, particularly since once we got into the car, what she was holding together all fell apart. And I don't even want to describe to you what I was staring at. We're very lucky that the hospital hadn't had a big bombing that day. It could have been a swamped emergency room. In fact, it was nearly empty.
You've described for us in a horrible scene, you know, Margaret's teeth in your clothing. And we're looking at pictures, by the way, Margaret. You're a beautiful woman even after the shooting. Stunning before, big bright blue eyes with, didn't matter what war zone you're in, you always had the black eyeliner on, sort of a Chrissy Hynde, you know, character, only more beautiful in the war zone. Steph, what's your sense of Margaret? She is legendary. What did it mean to you to have her as a camerawoman?
Well, I mean, I hate to start with the more lighthearted, but that was an important part of it. You know, these are high-pressure situations. You work with a lot of different people, a lot of different crews. You're all rotating in and out. And in these really stressful times, you have to be able to work together, because a decision to cross a bridge into a village where there's gunfire or not to, your team has to agree. As Margaret has said in the past, you don't go in thinking with a death wish, thinking you're going to get killed. You go in calculating that you can survive.
Right. And Margaret, in the film, we hear from many people who worked with you, Christiane Amanpour, the list is long, including a sound man who talks about, you know, he was umbilically attached to you through his cord and he had to go where you went. Let's listen.
I remember being with Margaret on Sniper Alley in Bosnia and Sarajevo, and Margaret would, like, run between the buildings and I was attached on a cable to her doing sound. So when she ran, you had to run. So I had to kind of, like, just be ready to go when she was ready to go. And sometimes I wasn't. You'd feel the cable, like, tug. And you'd realise that you're running out into view of the sniper, whether you liked it or not.
What was your thinking, Margaret, in filming? You said it wasn't that you were fearless, but you seemed to be. You were out in front.
Just what I need to do to get what I need and how best to go about it and remain as safe as you can be.
What to do to get what you need. It seemed to be, in many cases, just standing in one place as chaos broke out around you.
Yes, I'm a great believer in not making any sudden moves. I've seen the folly of that too often. Especially if you're carrying a camera and you run, often it looks like you have something on your shoulder. I stay very still.
And if you run, someone might think you have a rocket launcher or something.
Yes.
To the extent that we see in the film footage of yours taken of government gunmen in Georgia who are attacking a crowd walking right by you. Steph Katsonis, I think you were there in Georgia, am I wrong?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You tell a story about seasoned cameramen responding to what Margaret did.
Well, the funny thing was we were filming the demonstration as it was unfolding, and I, with my impeccable sense of what's about to come down the road, left. Before the gunmen opened fire. About, I don't remember now, let's say it was an hour later, half an hour later, all the reporters, all the camera people started rushing back into the hotel that we were all camped out in. And one of the, I think it was a British cameraman, said to me, "Your Margaret's amazing." And I said, "What? Why? What?" And the guy said to me, he said, "When these gunmen opened fire on the crowds, we did the obvious thing of scurrying and hiding behind the cars. And we were hunched down behind the cars, not getting the pictures." And this guy suddenly realized there was a shadow being cast over his arms and his camera. And he sort of was confused. He looks up into the sky and silhouetted against the light, the sunlight, is Margaret standing there tall and strong out in front of the cars, right in the middle of, just off to the side of the line of fire, filming these guys as they strode forth, looking like, you know, so many thugs, marching into the crowd of innocent people and firing at them.
That's producer Stefano Katsonis talking about legendary camerawoman Margaret Moth, the subject of CNN's new documentary, Fearless, The Margaret Moth Story, which is a reminder of how people do risk their lives for the pictures that often just run as background for quick news reports. We also are speaking with Margaret from the hospice in Minneapolis, where she's now coming to grips with an aggressive cancer. When we come back, did she really smack one of Saddam Hussein's secret police? That's just ahead. And later, there are some places where inter-office dating is illegal, as we'll hear. That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with legendary CNN camerawoman Margaret Moth. She was shot in the face by a sniper in Sarajevo in 1992, but after surgeries and with distorted speech, she went back repeatedly to war zones until an aggressive cancer prohibited that. Margaret is the subject of a new CNN documentary, Fearless, The Margaret Moth Story. One of the qualities that comes up over and over again in the film is her independent spirit. Here's her colleague, Hala Gharani.
She does not give a toss what anybody thinks about her. She has absolutely her own unique set of values of what she thinks is important in life. She doesn't care about the establishment, the whole what is expected of women. I mean, she's a true pioneer.
Correspondent Hala Gorani speaking about camerawoman Margaret Moth, who's on the line from a hospice center in Minneapolis as she copes with cancer. And a reminder, her speech was affected by that sniper wound in Sarajevo. We've also got Steph Katsonis here in the studio. He covered wars with Margaret. And Margaret, that clip reminds us of a story about you and Steph in Baghdad just after the Gulf War. Women are not allowed to walk the streets, so you were told by your Iraqi handler to stay in the car. But Steph sees a story in a market. You get out and you go to take a still photograph when a policeman slaps the camera away and hits your face, and you do what?
Now, my natural reaction was to hit back, and his cigarette went flying in the air.
This is one of Saddam Hussein's
secret policemen.
Secret policemen, and you smack him across the face.
No, well, the way I saw it was a little, she starts to take a picture, and then in moments behind us, fruit stalls, vendor stalls are tumbling over. The riot is catching fire. It's like watching gasoline go up in fire. She stood up, and you may not remember this, Margaret, but I remember your words. You slapped him and said, "Don't you ever," and slapped me in the face or something like that. And his cigarette flew, and you could hear a collective intake of air. You know, 500,000 civilian citizens of Saddam City and the CNN correspondent almost suffocated with fear when we saw her hit a secret policeman. And then the guy made believe he was going to arrest me and drag me away from the crowd, I think, just to save face.
That was funny. We had a lot of laughs there.
Yes, you did. Yeah. Yes, you did. Margaret, what was it about for you? The film tells your life story. The first female photographer in New Zealand, was it?
Yes. Yes. In Australia and New Zealand.
Australia and New Zealand, an avid skydiver. In fact, you took your name, Moth, from a tiger moth plane that you used to like to fly in. So always, obviously, an adventurer. But was it about adventure to be a war correspondent, a camera person, or was it about wanting to make sure those pictures got out?
I think it was curiosity as much as anything. Wars and conflicts often tend to be the turning points in history. And I think a lot of it was wanting to be there, to know what was really going on, to try and capture that on tape.
So the curiosity, a love of history, and an attempt to try to bring it back somehow for people. Steph, you remind us, too, always, that a camera person has one blind side.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's even more dangerous than we think.
Any situation like that, you look left and right and up and down and everywhere to stay alert and to stay safe. And the thing that has always amazed me is the discipline of Margaret and camera people like her to allow themselves not to look over their right shoulder, because they've always got blocking their view on that right shoulder a big black box of electronics. And they just have to trust the people who are with them, who are maybe grabbing them by the belt to pull them back or whispering in their other ear quietly to keep them alive. I mean, literally.
Do you think it made a difference?
Well, one would hope so, to inspire more interest and curiosity. But whether you succeed or not, I don't know.
Well, Margaret, and now, of course, the irony abounds. You know, you survive things that should be unsurvivable and are now struggling with a very aggressive cancer. In fact, we're speaking to you at a hospice in Minnesota. But, you know, you seem so accepting.
Well, I feel we all die, and I just feel in some ways it's irrelevant as to when you die, since you're going to die anyway. And I think it's more important how you live your life. I strive to get as much out of every day, every hour that I'm alive. Yeah. And I've never had a fear of dying, and I just feel I hope I can die with as much dignity as I've lived.
Can I tell a story about something Margaret told me not so long ago that pertains?
Please.
Margaret came over to visit a couple of months ago, get away for a weekend on the Cape with our good friend and her best friend, Joe. And we hadn't seen each other face-to-face for some years. And I was lamenting a little bit the passage of time, how time had caught up on me and how I would look in the mirror and was shocked to see an older fellow standing there staring back at me. And Margaret, who meanwhile is facing far greater challenges than looking in the mirror, said to me, "Wait a minute, Steph, you know, you read a book and you're on chapter 9, who the hell wants to go back to chapter 6? You want to keep on reading to the last chapter, don't you? Why look back? What do you care? And I've got to say, Margaret, that has not left me, that thought.
To me, it's just another adventure. It's the next chapter. Okay, yes, it may be the final chapter, but that's irrelevant. It's like, it's just another adventure in life. It's just another experience.
A lot of people have very wonderful sort of awakenings in their final days, or when they come to realize that they're going to die, and they inspire others in the way they confront it. Margaret didn't come to an awakening. This is simply a continuation. She's been awake the whole time.
Yeah. Which, Margaret, you'd have to be to have done the things that you've done. Margaret Moss, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And, of course, our thanks and admiration to our colleague Steph Katsonis, former war correspondent for CNN and producer for NPR's On Point. And, by the way, we'll link you to the CNN documentary about legendary camerawoman Margaret Moss at our website, hereandnow.org. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a mother comes to an uneasy acceptance of her son's gambling. Maybe it's not an addiction, maybe it will be his profession. That's tomorrow. But we will be back after the very latest news, Here and Now. The West Bank village of Susia in the arid South Hebron Hills has long been a disputed territory. The village is the site of an ancient Jewish city. Jewish settlers moved there in the 1980s. Palestinians have lived there for centuries, but recently they came as refugees after the 1948 war and are holding onto their land by living in tents and caves in the shadow of the Jewish settlers' modern complexes, because the Israeli government forbids the so-called cave dwellers from hooking up to running water or electricity. Now, a small group of Israelis is bringing wind and solar energy to the Palestinians. Their group is called Comet ME, or Middle East. Yossi Mossel is a volunteer with the group. He's in Boston on business and joins us in the studio. And Yossi, how did Comet ME get started?
So the people who founded it is Elad Orian and Noam Dotan. They're two physicists and longtime political activists. And they came to Susia about 4 years ago, started making friends and connections in the region and understanding the plight of the people in the region. Beyond their political activism, they're also technically inclined and they like to build stuff.
Building things like wind turbines. And we understand that they had to do this very much secretively because the law says that the Palestinians can't build.
Yeah, so there's always a danger that these systems will be considered an illegal structure. So when we raise a wind turbine, we try to do it very, very quickly, because from a legal point of view, it's much easier for the military to come and stop a work that is in progress than tear something that is already up.
How have you seen the wind turbines and other alternative energies change the lives there?
The Palestinians connected a butter-churning device to the plug that was being powered by the wind. And the importance of this is hard to overstate. The way they made butter until that day is they used the inside of a goat's stomach. And they put sheep's milk in that. And the women, another part of their daily chores is simply to shake this. And you have to shake this for 4 hours to make the butter. Mm. And then they had this machine, and within 45 minutes, we had butter. There was just simply huge smiles on everybody's faces. Butter in their society is not a luxury. Most of what their economy and what they eat is based on their sheep and milk. So going for 4 hours a day of doing this, suddenly this machine doing it, and it's ready within 45 minutes. So it completely changes their life.
Also what it's doing is giving them a deeper footprint on the ground. And as you well know, many hardliners in Israel are dead set against that. I mean, what do your friends say to you, or what do people say to you about enabling Palestinians to have deeper roots in an area where many Israelis hope they don't end up staying?
Well, first of all, there's very divergent opinions within Israeli society, so it depends on whom I'm talking with. If you talk about the political goals, and Comet definitely does have political goals and a political motivation of enabling the people, the Palestinians in Susia, to hold their ground, to stay on their land, with some people it becomes a much more difficult conversation.
And why is that important to you as an Israeli, to help a group of Palestinians hold on to their land?
for me as an Israeli, I see that only viable way out of the situation where Israel is today, really a long-term solution, is a two-state solution. And a two-state solution means Palestinian future state does have to have its land, has to have the space, has to have a viable economy for us to have a real peace. So in a way, it's something that I see as very, very important for the future of Israel. And that's, I have to say, that's where my sentiments are with having Israel as a long-existing state. The beauties of Comet, that it goes beyond peace, is a very abstract and large word. It is actually people working together and shoulder to shoulder and eating the same food. The amount of tea I've drunk there, or the amount of food I've drunk there, is really beyond description. There's a real and very deep friendship between the people who are very much involved there. That is peace.
Yossi Mosel with the group Comet ME, providing solar and wind energy to West Bank Palestinians who up until then were cut off from electricity and running water. Yossi, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, Comet ME is now a finalist in the BBC World Challenge. That's a global competition that rewards grassroots innovation. Yossi says if they win the $20,000 prize, they plan to bring more solar and wind power to Palestinians. We'll be back in 30 seconds here and now. Workplace relationships are in the spotlight in the wake of David Letterman's story, that alleged blackmail scheme that threatened to expose relationships he'd had with staffers who worked on his show. We've had a lot of response to our reports, ranging from "Who cares?" to "Is a boss dating a staffer a violation of some federal law?" Well, let's take a look at that. David Letterman is self-employed. His worldwide pants production company does not prohibit inter-office romances, but other companies do, and they happen anyway. Surveys show about half of employees questioned say they've had an office romance. Thomas Anastasi is professor of organizational behavior at Boston University, and so, professor, to that question we had from a listener, is there a federal law against, you know, these kinds of relationships?
Depending on whether it's private or government. In the government, there is a federal law that says bosses cannot date employees. Now you think, oh my gosh, what about Bill Clinton? Hmm. Well, since Bill Clinton was president, he falls under a constitutional law, which is why he was exempt.
And we should just jump in to say he was, though, impeached because he had misrepresented that relationship, not because of the relationship.
People in the workplace can date if it's consensual.
Well, actually, we still do have a couple of questions. You say people can date is no problem, but are there companies that have restrictions, let's say, on people who are bosses dating subordinates?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
There are some bans.
Some companies have what we call non-fraternization policies. The unexpected consequence of action, as UPS found, is that all of a sudden you've got Adele sitting there, now they're doing something wrong and they have to sneak off to a different town.
What happened to UPS?
They have a non-fraternization policy, and one things that we found is that people date all the time.
So that's one company that has the non-fraternization policy.
Mm-hmm.
Are there companies that allow certain kinds of fraternization but frown on others?
The general gist is most companies do not allow bosses to date subordinates because there's such a power in differential.
Sure, that's a question that has not come up yet in the David Letterman case, but some people are wondering if, in fact, there are staffers who are going to come forward and say, well, actually, you know, I was kind of feeling left out because the people that he dated got on-air slots and they, you know, seemed to be having a lot of fun and I felt excluded from that. So it's almost as if you feel that that relationship is keeping you from getting a promotion, a company could hear from employees about that.
That's when the people are going to start saying, you're discriminating against me because I'm not sleeping with the boss. Mm-hmm. And that creates massive amounts of problems.
Have there been lawsuits along that line?
Oh, sure. It's sexual discrimination because someone sits there and says, okay, I'm going for this promotion and I'm more qualified than this other person, but this other person sleeping with the boss, they can file a discrimination suit.
I'm wondering also, are companies leery about what happens when office relationships break up?
Oh, they hate it. We spend more awake time with the people we work with than anybody else in our life. Imagine going through a breakup. It's always painful, but then you have to spend 2,000 hours or more with that person every year.
Well, in fact, are there lawsuits there? I'm wondering if there are people who feel perhaps they were half of an interoffice relationship,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe they're moved out of a certain position because it becomes intolerable for people to work with each other. I mean, tell us more about the potential side effects of that.
Companies have two standards they have to meet. For a sexual harassment suit, there has to be what we call management acceptance, and there has to be what's called a hostile environment. A hostile environment is an environment which a reasonable person would find psychologically damaging or difficult. Well, being next to the person that you just dated and broke up with, someone could say this is now a hostile environment. So they go to the company, and if the company says, you know what, we don't want to deal with this, that's your problem, work it out, now they can sue for what's called management acceptance. They have not taken ownership of the problem.
Huh.
Management needs to make what we call reasonable accommodations. So they have to sit there and say, okay, we're going to put you in a different building.
Without one half of the couple feeling that it's been punitive.
Right. The other problem that companies have is that you've got two coworkers, they start dating, and then one gets promoted. And next thing you know, you never signed up to have your boss be your the person you're dating or your spouse, but it kind of worked out that way. And so that can create problems, too.
In fact, how much time did you find that human resource people spend on this issue?
Oh, every week, one or two or three days. I mean, it's something that is, for a big company, it's definitely something that is on their plate all the time. And it gets ratcheted up when you have companies that have government contracts, because when people have security clearances, if they enter into an inter-office romance, all of a sudden people have got something on them. For instance, in the David Letterman case, it was blackmail. Well, if somebody has secrets privy only to the Air Force and their company, someone could go and say, well, you know, unless you give me the details about what you're working on, I'm going to make your affair public.
Well, and, you know, some people might go their entire career and never find this a problem. Other people are sitting in a cubicle right now fuming over something that's going on in their cubicle. How do you know, bottom line, how your company feels about this? How do you know if a company has any policies on it?
Most companies with 20 or more employees should have a written sexual harassment policy. And if they don't, they should probably call a lawyer really quickly and have them draw one up for them. The EEOC has got some guidelines for what they think should be in the sexual harassment policy, and most companies follow that.
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
They're the ones who enforce the sexual harassment laws federally.
Well, you say that some companies have notification policies that you have to report a consensual romantic relationship.
Correct.
And there's even something called a love contract?
Yes. That was developed by a lawyer. You know, lawyers in love, it's a wonderful thing, but that's just not how people actually interact.
Well, but it's something that the people who put it together see as sort of a way of having on paper that this is a consensual relationship agreement. Nobody can later say that they were coerced.
I think that for government contracts that take this very, very seriously, for instance, I was talking to an HR manager who worked for a big government contractor, and a person was having an affair, and they disclosed it to their company. That protected their job. And I think that's kind of a variation of the love contract.
Well, it's just really interesting looking at some of the details. For instance, they could outline what's expected in the relationship. No signs of affection at work, you know, no retaliation if the relationship ends. But, you know, you mentioned something else, and it brings another question. We've been talking about dating. Some people would very much distinguish between dating and affairs.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, do companies have stricter policies or stricter HR thoughts when it's a married person?
Absolutely. They don't want to have on the front page CEO of this family-friendly company caught in affair.
Thomas Anastasi, professor of organizational behavior at Boston University. His upcoming book is The Successful Entrepreneur, and one of those chapters is What to Do About Dating in Your Business.
Yes, and the reason I wrote that book is that lots of people when they start businesses are all of a sudden they're HR managers, marketing managers, and they have absolutely no idea that their company could be lost if they get one sexual harassment suit. Sexual harassment suits can cost a company $70,000, $80,000, $90,000.
Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. And now we turn to a kerfuffle in the art world. A probe has been launched into claims that artworks featured in a new book about the famed Mexican artist Frida Kahlo are fakes. The claims are coming from critics and dealers in the art world, and they want the book pulled from the shelves. But the publishers of Barbara Levine's book, Finding Frida Kahlo, say the book makes it clear that some of the items featured are not 100% authenticated. The book includes diary entries, letters, sketches, and purports to document a treasure trove of more than 1,200 Kahlo items on display in a Mexican antique store. You can see pictures of some of the material in the book at our website, hereandnow.org, as the BBC's Andrew Purcell begins his story with the book's author, Barbara Levine, describing what happened when she discovered what she thinks are four chests of Kahlo material in a dusty back room.
The clothing, the notebooks, the drawings, the paintings. Then I came across a self-portrait by Kahlo, which just sort of made me freeze. I felt like I had come upon an archaeological site that needed exploration. It was really overwhelming that it could possibly be for you, Kahlo.
Her first reaction was disbelief that so much work by a major 20th century artist could remain undiscovered for so long, doubts that she owns up to in the book.
It is hard to believe. Let's just say that it is a fictitious archive. Who would be so obsessed with Frida Kahlo that they would create 1,200 primarily ephemeral, non-exhibition quality materials? That's an interesting story in and of itself.
The owner, Carlos Nayola, says there's a simple reason it stayed hidden. Kahlo, he claims, deliberately left it to sculptor Abraham Jimenez Lopez, who was a close friend in the last years of her life, to keep it separate from the official archive at her house, the Casa Azul, in the outskirts of Mexico City.
The first owner of the collection kept it silently for more than 25 years and never wanted to show it or sell it to anyone because Frida told him that these were very personal, intimate things that she didn't want to keep in the Casa Azul because she knew that when she died, everything would end up in a museum and that would expose her intimacy to everyone.
The first item from the archive to be released was a painting with Kahlo's head superimposed on the body of a deer. It was immediately denounced as a fake, but no one really took it seriously until Levine's book threatened to make the whole collection known to a much wider audience. Last month, a group of celebrated Kahlo scholars, including her biographer Hayden Herrera, the executor of her trust Carlos Phillips Olmedo, and the author of her catalogue raisonné Salomon Grimberg, wrote an open letter to Mexico's Arts Council urging it to put a stop to this type of fraud. New York art dealer Marianne Martin, a specialist in Latin American art, also signed the letter. I went to meet her. I came to your gallery this morning with my copy of Finding Frida Kahlo, but we've gone upstairs to your office to take your copy, which is in front of us now, and it's covered in post-it notes, something 30, 40, 50 post-it notes coming out of the side of the book, and each of them marking a major discrepancy or some major proof, as far as you're concerned, that this work is a forgery.
Yes, well, why don't we just say that the title Finding Frida Kahlo has been a challenge, and that I've been looking for Frida Kahlo in this book for almost a month, and I haven't found her yet.
Do you think literally every single one of these 1,200 pieces is a forgery?
Everyone that's reproduced, I think if you examine it, you will find some spelling error or some anachronism or some evidence that the work is based on other known works, but I don't think you are going to find the hand of Frida Kahlo. I think you find the hand of a number of people who have worked on this archive. It's not just the work of one person.
Okay, well, let's look at some items in this book and some of your specific criticisms.
I think the one that I find the most telling is a self-portrait. Let's see if I can find it. It's on page 59, and Frida is holding two amputated legs in her arms. The painting is based on a photograph, a well-known photograph of Frida. In this photograph, she's wearing the identical shawl, the identical beads, the identical earrings. Her hair is parted in the middle and worn in the same style, except that this photograph was made, I think, in 1933, and Frida didn't have her amputation until the 50s. There's a total anachronism here because she wouldn't have been holding her amputated legs when she was 25 years old.
Yeah, now radio listeners can't see this, obviously, but you'll have to take my word for it. The photograph and the painting do look almost identical.
There's a series of recipes that Frida has supposedly done, and every single one of the recipes is signed by Frida. Now, do you ever write down a recipe, do you sign your name on the recipe? It doesn't make any sense.
Carlos Niola says he's been scrupulous in proving the archive's authenticity. The graphologist he hired confirmed that the handwriting is Carlos. Chemical analysis of the paint showed that it dates from the 1940s. Carlos' protégés, Arturo Garcia Bustos and Arturo Estrada, believe it to be genuine. To Niola, the establishment is crying fraud because it's a closed shop, worried about losing its monopoly.
They say the work is fake, with arguments that are illogical, incongruent, and invalid, with no objective basis. None of these critics have seen a single piece of the archive in person. What makes me very sad is that Mexico's art institutions haven't shown any interest in this archive either. They're a mafia, but, well, Frida Kahlo belongs to the world, not only to Mexico.
And that is the current situation, a Mexican standoff with neither side willing to budge. It should be reasonably, not easy, but it's certainly possible to establish whether these things were painted in the 1940s or last year.
Nobody would bother to go to San Miguel de Allende to see these things to begin with. If they'd seen even one photograph, they would say, well, no, that's not worth my trouble.
Lots of the people that signed that letter are in Mexico. It's not that much trouble to go to. If you're so certain that these are forgeries, why not give it the time of day and go up there and prove it?
Well, in a way, it's giving credibility to the lie that it's necessary to go see these things. I mean,
it's challenging the lie.
Mr. Noyola has never invited me to come and look at these things. The Noyolas are constantly saying, well, our doors are open to any serious scholar who wants to come and study these things. If it were really necessary to go there, I suppose we could go there. But we're being forced to do something that we know is inherently silly.
Carlos Niola is in negotiations with a gallery in Tucson, Arizona, to exhibit the collection there early next year. Meanwhile, images from the archive are being passed around on the internet, blurring the lines between what's true and what isn't, intertwining Frida Kahlo's reality with other people's fantasies.
The nature of an icon such as Kahlo is that everybody feels like she's there for them. You know, there's a magnetic appeal there. So you want to believe that you're having special insight, a special connection with her life.
My greatest hope would be that this book could be stopped before it gets out too far, because I think it will do a lot of damage. If these things are accepted, they're not accepted, but I mean, were these things to be accepted, then anything goes.